CliffCentral.com.
That's right. Notorious B.I.G. And if you don't know, now you know. Oh, I love it. All right. So many things to get to today, and your message is always welcome on 079. What is it again?
079.
Yeah.
748.
2090, right?
Yes.
Eventually, sure. How many years?
Just so casually 6 years.
So embarrassing. Oh, my God.
No, but we used to have 0861555189.
Yeah. Oh, so many different numbers to remember.
Should have Googled it.
Yeah. You know what?
Because
that's a good plan. Have you ever Googled your own number? See if you come up?
No.
Someone told me you can do that. Does your number?
You
does your name?
Not.
See, are you serious?
Yes. I've Googled my number. I've Googled my full names. I've Googled like the shortened version of my name. You need to know what's out there. You need to know what your digital footprint is.
So what does it say with your number? Does it recognize that it's yours?
Yeah. And also there are a couple of things that we've sent out that have
press
me
releases.
As,
okay.
Yeah, that have me as a contact number. So
your number should not be out there on the internet. So yeah, this is how serial killers find you.
Uh-oh. Don't say that to him. Of all the people you could have said that to, Sia's the last one should have heard that. Oh, my God.
He needs to hear that.
Oh, my God.
Well, I'm not exactly, like, answering calls at midnight.
Oh, Pumi.
But once someone did that to me, but it was just a stupid prank.
Now you've done it, Pumi.
No. You should not have your number out there. This is one of the things I'm trying to figure out about how to block people, like video calling you on Messenger. Because, you know, through your Facebook Messenger, people can call you. You are a stranger. This is proper stranger danger. This is how those things happen to you. Your number out in the public domain.
Well, I just have to say I have a friend who's cheating and they live by Messenger.
Oh, really?
Because their spouse would never even think of checking Messenger. And you know, now Messenger is a separate app to Facebook.
Yes.
So if your spouse would suspect anything, they'd go into your Facebook profile, but they wouldn't think of going to Messenger in particular.
Oh,
they are having a field day.
Cheaters, huh?
I have so many questions.
Me too. You know what's annoying is when people who are cheating tell you, I hate that. Like, don't make me a part of your mess now.
Yeah,
don't
because now you're involved. Yeah,
because now I'm in the moral quagmire.
It's like two friends of mine broke up during lockdown, and I always refuse to take sides in these things because they're going to get back together, and then you're the bad guy. You know what I mean?
So you've already taken sides, Gareth.
No, I haven't taken sides. I refuse to be friends with one and not the other. And I'm not going to choose. Neither of them is to blame. And even if they were, it's none of my business, right? And they both are my friends. It's a guy and a girl. They've been seeing each other for a while. I don't see why I should be involved in this. So I'm just not choosing sides. I won't put one over the other.
So are you just going to ignore their messages?
Well, yeah. I'm not going to. I will see them both separately or together. But I will not be involved in their stuff, you know, they're quarreling. It's not
You're opening
business.
Up Pandora's box here. Now, what you need to do is set rules. They mustn't tell you about the other person because I know exactly what you're talking about. And you know they're going to say, oh, John, I love him, but he's impossible. He's like his father. Gareth, talk to him. And nonsense like that. So you must set rules to say, if we're together, I don't want you spewing poison about the other person. Otherwise,
listen here. Being a friend in a separation, whether it's a divorce or a breakup, it's a lot like being the kids. Because who gets the friends is a big thing.
Uh-oh.
Who gets the friends is a big thing. My rule of thumb is: if you were my friend before the other person, if I know your person through you. They are not my person. You are my person.
Ooh. Yes, I agree.
Wow. Jesus, that makes it hard. It's so complicated.
And, And then I don't care if my person was the one who did wrong. I'll still side with them.
They're your person.
Yeah.
There's another level.
Yeah.
What happens when you get along with a family member? So my ex-girlfriend.
I know people who are, they're friends with their ex-in-laws, basically. And they weren't married. That's wild. The ex's family love him, for example.
That's messy.
Terrible. My gosh. Now he's pushing up at like family weddings.
Well, I don't know if that happens, but it's certainly there is, you know, there's some complications that creep in.
Blexa.
Yeah.
No, you have to cut ties. No, you. Then what's next? Like, you'll be invited for afternoon tea.
Oh, yeah.
There'll be no, then the next, for the next person, the next girlfriend or slash boyfriend or slash significant other, there's no space for them because you are taking up the space. You must be gracious and walk away, man.
You reckon,
you break up, you break up with me, you break up with all my people. I don't know how much you loved them. You break up with all my people.
Mm-hmm.
So my girlfriend, two girlfriends ago, we went on a trip.
My girlfriend, two girlfriends ago. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's how I count.
I got you. Yeah, all right.
So we went on this awesome trip together.
Uh-huh.
I went with her family, and the photos of that trip were up in the house. And her and myself and her mom got along like a house on fire. And she's married now.
Oh God.
Yeah, and he's that guy.
And the photos like of the fact, you are still up in the house?
Oh, I mean, it's probably the trip of a lifetime, the ski trip of a lifetime.
No, it's not that he's that guy. You are the guy. Your photos are still up on the wall.
No, it's their house. What do I do? Go there, take my photos off the wall.
Wait,
like myself and her mom have a great relationship, plutonic.
Is it their marital house or is it her mother's house?
The family house. So he got triggered that my photos are still up there.
Damn right he should.
She should take them down.
You see, these are the things.
You are that guy.
I'm that guy for what?
If you are the guy on top of it, she should go and take down those pictures. Girlfriend from two girlfriends back, if you are listening, go to your mother's house and remove all traces of Mbulelo.
Here's what then I say,
I think Bulelo's taking a bit of a thrill out of all of this.
No, here's what, this. So it's even more ridiculous.
That's why.
Yeah.
The house is in Slovakia.
So
it's not even in this country. Like, no. I am here, guy. Chill. You guys live in Germany. Nishadile. I'm here. But it was
cold. You are there. You are there.
It's all you. I'm with Pumi. Like, you.
Then
you
I say, boyfriend of two girlfriends ago, if you are listening.
Husband.
Even worse. God. I know it's not winter on your side of the world, but look, just complain it's chilly one night. You need to start a bonfire and you use those photos
to
light up a fire.
And
burn, baby.
Bulelo, you don't care, right? You sure you don't care about this?
About him being triggered.
No, about the pictures being up. Are you taking a thrill out of that?
Because myself and the mom maintained a relationship. We really hit it off. So go fly a kite, bro. She chose you. Like,
this
I'm out.
Is Mbulelo. This stokes Mbulelo's sadistic nature.
Jesus.
How would you feel if it was done to you, Mbulelo?
He won. He's got her. They just had a kid. Dude, what do you want? You've won. You got the girl. She's awesome. Like, what is wrong with you? Move on. It's not even their house. They live in Germany. The house is in Slovakia.
You move on. Yes. You move on.
By being pulled off the wall.
Yes, absolutely. Damn it.
You have no place on those people's wall, Mbulelo.
Since we're talking about marital and relationship woes, listen to this Johannesburg man who is clearly on an apology tour. They've hidden his real name, but the piece calls him Peter.
Uh-huh.
Peter is 33 years old, lives in Johannesburg. He's a businessman, has been married for 12 years, and has had a girlfriend for a little over a year. And right now, he has tested positive for corona because he left the house and went to see his girlfriend, and that's where he contracted it. So now Peter has written a piece apologizing profusely to his wife and reiterating how it was just such a stupid decision, and he hopes other people wouldn't do such a thing to endanger their loved ones.
I have one piece of advice for that wife. Kaba Inja, kick him out.
Yeah, wow, that's not on, huh? That's really not
part of Peter's whole piece. He says, this pandemic has been strenuous on both of my relationships.
Are you looking for sympathy?
That's exactly it. He says, before this pandemic, I was able to balance the two relationships. I would go on trips with my girlfriend or see her on weekends or after work. The lockdown has made things very tricky for us. We can't even go on a weekend getaway or grab lunch or dinner at our favorite restaurants. We've been quite restricted. So the only way I knew we could spend quality time together was by visiting her at her home. And then, long story short, it just so happened that this girlfriend's neighbor has corona. And so the neighbors used to see one another. And when Peter went over, that's how he got the virus. He says, thankfully, his wife hasn't tested positive. His wife has been self-isolating in their home and under the impression that he picked it up initially at the office. But right now, he feels bad and he just feels relieved that he at least is the only one who tested positive.
The wife doesn't, she still doesn't know?
Still doesn't know, but is just apologizing to all of us random Joe Soaps. Peter, stand up. Tell your wife the truth.
What a bastard. That's not on at all.
Swine.
Yeah,
so what's the worst part? That he cheated or the fact that he gave her COVID? Because those are two different things.
Why are they two different things? They are intertwined.
Okay. I looked at them separately.
He is a horrible, horrible human being. You don't do that. I mean, he's telling everyone except the wife. Aibo, please.
Yeah, you don't do that. You don't give your wife COVID.
No.
Johannesburg women who have a spouse that's 33 years old and you got married when you were 21. Process of isolation. We'll find the real Peter.
Yeah, my favorite is that's not an apology. That's a sorry I got caught.
Yeah.
He's not apologizing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he's not sorry at all.
He hasn't been caught.
No, but his moral, you know, obviously it's the guilty conscience. You know, the worst is never what people think of you. It's you in the pillow. He's now, it's eating him. Yes.
It's him in the sanctity of the toilet.
Yeah, exactly.
That's horrible, though. That is horrible. Yeah, what a son of a bitch.
This proves exactly how it's not an apology. Listen to this paragraph. He says, I was selfish to go out and visit my girlfriend, as I have now put my life at risk for it. Because of my selfish decision, I couldn't even attend a business meeting in another city.
Oh, God. Well, you probably got another girlfriend.
Yeah.
It's not because of my selfish decision, you know, I feel bad for my wife. No,
this guy,
none of that.
It's me the whole time with him, huh?
Exactly. It's not an apology. He's a victim.
So I know we're laughing at him and this entire situation right now. But to be serious for a second, this is exactly what happened with a whole lot of people when AIDS swept through the country, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the exact same thing.
Absolutely.
It's the reason why you have to protect yourself. And then you have to be honest with people around you. And I don't particularly care if people need to be in throuples or all of those kinds of things.
Yeah.
It's when you don't tell the other person and give them the opportunity to 100%. Be safe that it is problematic. Because that's exactly what it is. Is you can be, and we see it. I mean, I think the social media world has completely made us okay with the fact that they are like side chicks and whatever, girlfriends and slay queens and all of that stuff. It's kind of, it's made it okay in our lives.
It's normalized it a little. Yeah.
And to have Jacob Zuma and his six wives and the king and, you know, to have all of that kind of become part of our society has made it okay. But the difference being that all those people know, all those people who are in polygamous marriages know that they are in polygamous marriages. And so they have a choice they make that decision. But if you don't let the other person know, then you're just an asshole.
I agree with you. I always say, in cheating, whenever someone gets caught, it's never about the cheating. It's always about respect me enough to hide it better, number one.
I swear I'll write that on your tombstone.
That's what it is. And to Pumi's point, if you're going to do this, be honest, Chief.
Why hide it, though? Why hide it? If that's who you are, why hide it?
But people are embarrassed, you see. That's the problem. It's not, even if it is who they are, they don't want to acknowledge that. They want to be seen as virtuous by the rest of society. They want society to say, oh, you know, Peter, nice guy. He's not a nice guy. He's a son of a bitch.
Yeah. Exposing people to COVID.
Exactly. What a piece of shit. Sorry, Peter. I don't have time for you.
Yeah. And Peter, I'm sorry you can't spend time with your girlfriend anymore as well. It's tough.
I just don't even know why there was a need to write this piece.
It was to himself. The letter is not for anyone. It's, I'm sorry that you are in a bad situation. It's ridiculous. He is ridiculous.
Yeah. He tries to make a public service announcement at the end of what he says. He ends it off by saying, I know how selfish I was and how inconsiderate my decision was. I want to urge South Africans to stay at home and only go out when it's necessary. Are we really going to listen to you here, Peter? But anyway, then he says, our inconsiderate decisions are not flattening the curve. I'm no saint in all of this, but I got a serious wake-up call about this virus.
This guy really wants attention, hey?
Unbelievable.
Suga.
What? Suga. Son of a bitch. Yeah, really. Suga, exactly. That's the only appropriate response to Peter. Sorry, dude. Suga. How low can you go?
Clearly you can go Peter low.
Jesus. Anyway, all right. So. Sorry.
Well then.
Peter, is that you?
Yeah. So let me read this to you quickly, because this is something Josh Lindberg wrote. And Josh has been in the entertainment business for a long time. I'm not going to read you the whole thing, but he says, here's some highlights from it. While we can and do create amazing virtual spaces, content and while technology is and can be amazingly beneficial, nothing can replace the live interaction between a live audience with live performers. He's talking about actors, singers, dancers. He notes that it is the small and medium-sized gig industries that are the lifeblood, energy, and gears of any economy. To this day, he is still to hear from any colleague, here or internationally, who's received any relief funding at all, from any government.
Now that's a kicker.
Yeah, he acknowledges artists are not alone. Many are facing tough challenges. Many cannot work from home for many different reasons. He describes himself as an artist. I'm a creator. I'm a storyteller. He truly believes the worldwide lockdown should, can, and will change us forever. He concludes by specifying, he says this, I do not have all the answers, but I do know that with our creative brains working together with our scientific, mathematical, and learned experiences, we can do extraordinary things. So, Josh, I mean, it's good to see you, dude. First of all, well done on the letter, which I think is getting quite a lot of traction all over the place. Artists have been hit particularly hard by COVID. As you say in the letter, there's nothing that we could do online virtually that will ever replace what people do when they're seeing live performances. And I think it's such a beautifully written piece of emotional. I mean, you're pouring out your heart and soul here, and you're speaking not just for yourself, but for everyone else, right? Beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity, and good morning.
Morning, man.
Nice to see you too.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I was listening to you guys now, and yes, you can connect in a virtual world. You guys have been chatting. I've been listening. I've been part of your conversation by listening. You guys chatting to each other remotely, interact with each other and bounce off each other. But the live interaction with an audience, be it a musician, a dancer, a singer, a poet, even when there's live interaction with technology like screens and audiovisual environments, and that virtual world live, they interact with each other. They influence each other.
Yeah,
they're different every night.
Now, What have you been doing during lockdown? Because you've said it yourself, it's impossible to ply your trade while you're sitting at home. It's not something that can be done as easily. And I mean, maybe you can do more than some, because you seem to me to be one of those people who's smart enough to figure out various ways and means of doing things. But I mean, it's even harder for like a dancer. What the hell does a dancer do, right?
So I was grappling with that. I was thinking, so what do we do? So first of all, I'm humbled by this experience. I'm not sure how good school at home teacher with my two kids. That has been incredibly humbling in learning how to be a better person, a better father, a better parent. Zoraida is also studying at home, so I have to assist her and create space where I can.
Oh, you mean she's not lifting her fair share at the moment?
Oh, no, she does. She's a far better cook than I am.
Just about to say, call that woman over to the phone.
She's doing amazing things because she is contributing in terms of what she's studying. It's also talking about otherness and diversity in her master's, and it's fascinating to read it. But I was grappling with that question. So what do we do? How do I solve this? How do I contribute to this in some way? I don't just want to exist in a virtual Zoom world.
Right.
Gareth, when we create shows, they are often beautifully technological. They embrace technology. We're going to create spaces that have kinetic screens that change with the audience's environment, projecting onto buildings in found spaces, whatever it may be. You're not just a voyeur sitting in a darkened auditorium watching something ahead of you. You are part of that experience by creating a very immersive experience. So technology is very, very important and has done amazing things. So I can make a Zoom call incredible. We can create amazing graphics that pop out of the screen and bring it to life, even helping the speakers speak in better ways. But there has to be more. And I think of this COVID world as an opportunity for everyone to go, well, how can we be better? This is a universal thing that's affecting us all.
Better. Most people are just trying to survive, Josh. I mean, that's the other reality, right? Is that some people don't know how to do anything other than what they've been doing.
So I didn't either. I didn't have the answer either. And I'm still grappling with that. And I think I've arrived at where we all have to be more creative. Every single business, when it's being more creative, every single scientific mind, when it's being more creative, mathematical or biological mind, when it's being more creative, has ended up putting someone on the moon or curing a disease. So we all have to go, oh, hang on a second. How can I be more creative? What else is there? What else is there that I can do? And I've got ideas. I've come up with ideas to create amazing shows that feel positive, that add a positive story to our world right now. So how do we view them then? I can't just film it. You've got to be immersed within it. When we're sitting in an audience, I feel the interaction of the people left or right of me.
Yeah. You can't operate without that audience, right?
Yeah. So that is part of it too. So there are ways of doing that. But I think there's even more than that. We can create movable drive-in experiences. I don't want just little bubbles around everybody so we're all protected in some way. We have to have that tangible two-way interaction. And the important thing is that I think the conversation must continue. This conversation we're having right now is a start of it. Let's hope it sparks other conversations right now too and gets other people thinking. The arts have always had a trouble to breathe life into the work. Whatever your art
okay,
is.
So like you come from a very artistic family, a very creative family. Now, how does the theater world, which your mom and dad are so prominently involved in, how's that coping? Because these people don't have money. For some of them, it's not even a question of being more creative or finding new. They basically just need food. Right?
We appreciate and acknowledge the importance of a lockdown and this situation. But when people put out and governments put out funding and solutions in that way, why does the Baxter Theatre or the Market Theatre or so on struggle so hard, even an established institution? And it doesn't stop there. Every single artist that I know has literally had to bleed to make a production in the best of times. People don't really understand what that means. It's almost comical. Oh, the struggling artist. Artists are trying to make themselves more professional, more learned in the world of marketing themselves and managing themselves properly. But to get a production up on its feet, even in the best of times, is very, very difficult. And the governments have not put funding into the arts. The artists have always told the truth.
All right, but let me ask you a serious question now, because this is probably where it gets a bit controversial. I don't believe that public funding should be available to the arts. I think artists should, whether they are painters, singers, dancers, actors, writers, whoever, they should succeed on the merits of their work. I don't like the idea that the taxpayer has to supplement and subsidize a lot of the crap that people call art, that they're churning out because they can't do anything that the market's actually interested in. Don't you think there's a middle ground there somewhere? Because I don't want my tax money being spent, which should be spent on providing water and electricity to poor people, for example. I don't want that spent on some guy who pisses on a canvas. Do you know what I mean?
I do, and I agree with you. I agree with you to the point that everything should be a meritocracy. We need the world to become more like that. Artists don't want handouts either.
Some of them do, though.
Perhaps, but I think that the corporate world or the corporate sector, the individuals in business can also support the arts. We can communicate those stories in interesting ways. There's many ways of looking at the arts that are not just let's put on hang up a piece of art on the wall, write something or produce something that ends up on a stage and so on, funded by a government. Mm. Let's also remember that governments have used the arts or the arts have been used to call out governments.
Absolutely.
Facts. Yeah, there you go, right? So in our apartheid time, for some strange reason, the world knew about what the atrocities of what was happening in our country, in a large part due to the work being done at certain theatres in this country and by certain artists in this country.
Sure.
And those, Gareth,
yeah. Sorry, Josh, is you even look at the McCarthy era, you know, some of the literature that came in that time that was disguised as purely plays and poetry was a commentary of what was happening within the era. So if we don't fund the arts, who will tell us about oppression? Who will tell us about these things? We must fund the arts. It's vital for me.
So you reckon government should be paying for this stuff?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, calm down. You're going to blow a vein in your head. I mean, you know, we actually wanted to get Josh all fired up, Josh, on this, not you.
No. Gareth, let's get everybody fired up.
Okay.
Because the arts, it's not just when things are really, really tough in terms of the apartheid or the McCarthy era. Right now, there's these interesting things to talk about, and they always are. You're right. The governments do need to fund priority things, and people do need priority things to get a job, to get sanitation, water, lights, and so on, to live a decent life. And then, what about the stories that are not told? And the artists can tell the stories.
Yeah.
The jester was the one that was not beheaded in the kingdom, and for some reason, the jester was allowed to tell the truth. The artists, we look at a comedian and we laugh, but they're telling the truth.
Yeah. No. Listen, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying there isn't value. I mean, I think the arts are tremendously important. And, you know, both you and Mbulelo make a very good case for it. I'm just saying there's so many people asking for handouts. Yesterday we saw the taxi industry claiming that government's 1.3 billion rand that they're giving to them to help them make it through COVID is not enough. So now we've got the taxi industry that taxpayers have to subsidize. Then it's the art industry, the art movements. Then before you know it, the taxpayers are suddenly paying for everybody to have sheltered employment. And I think that the arts are uniquely positioned, and I think this is where you and I probably agree, the arts are uniquely positioned to put out product, whether it's in terms of performances or production or actual articles that you know, artifacts, in fact, that are human achievements on their own, that this stuff, people will pay for that. It doesn't have to be governments.
It doesn't have to be government, but here's the interesting thing. We are all in this together. There's a reason this is happening to all of us together, right? At the same time, there's another other movements, Black Lives Matter movements, is asking very interesting questions of all of us together at the same time. Global warming, we can debate it, but the conversations must happen. We don't just want, the handouts are not going to solve everything. Everybody can go on a strike and make a handout work. Sorry, Pumi, you want to say something?
You know, I mean, I think the thing about art and being in a part of it, of the art industry that is funded by clients, right? One of the things that I've always found a disjuncture, where it disconnects, is when you make it more about who is going to fund this thing rather than this needs to happen. It needs to be created. This conversation needs to be had and have the conversation and create the pieces of work and get the people who are interested, get the minds of the people who need the light shone at them to engage with it is what you need far more than somebody has got to pay for this. Because the problem with somebody has got to pay for this is, as we all know, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And so at which point do the two, because that's what governments do. Governments then go, I don't like what is being said here.
Yes.
Therefore, I'm going to starve it of money.
Or and it becomes propaganda, right?
And that's where the difference is. For me, artists are people who, despite who will pay for it, because this thing needs to be said, because this piece of work needs to find, to be birthed, as it were, they do it anyway. So on the one hand, I understand what you're saying about you need to find a way to make a living. But it's the reason why even Michelangelo would, on the one hand, do a Sistine Chapel and be paid by the church, and on the other hand, pay for his own work, you know, and buy the cadavers he needs to dissect on the other side. Is you've got to find a way to balance the two out. And that's what true artists need to be able to do. They've got to find a way to be able to balance it out. Because for as long as you are dependent on another person giving you the money, they are going to tell you what they want you to say. Then you have to disguise it as
Michelangelo cut up the cadavers to look at the structure of the human body to make himself a better artist, to challenge himself further, right? And so we as artists are doing that. But I do think this is
the cutting up cadavers? You're taking this very seriously, Josh. I'm starting to worry.
Locus Project. Gareth, let me challenge you on this question, and I think that this is a really important point.
Yeah.
Small to medium-sized businesses of any kind in any country, in any economy, are the lifeblood of that economy.
Absolutely.
Those are the ones that are struggling right now. I think the challenge for us all is to, not just the artists, the challenge for us all is to go, we have to restructure, redefine what an economy actually even is.
Mm.
How is it defined, and how does that stock market work? And those numbers all equate into this thing that goes up and down on a red line graph.
We don't need to redefine those things. They're already pretty well established and defined, and it's all questions of supply and demand. And I don't think we need to reestablish definitions here. We don't need to take it all down.
Not definitions, but if we just unlock and go back to work, well, that's not going to be so easy, because the theatre is not just going to open up and we're going to quickly put that stage back on. It's not a shop that opens its doors and you restock it. Well, so how do we go back to work?
What I loved about your letter is that it came from the heart, and you're speaking for the I think a lot of people in the creative industries. But what also got to me was the fact that there are probably theatres right now that are probably not going to – they're not opening up again, right? There's no money.
Yeah.
And that's very, very sad. So give me a little insight into the friends and colleagues that you have in the industry and what they're saying at the moment, what they're actually experiencing.
First of all, they've created spaces where they can exist. Most of them have created shared spaces. They are having conversations through podcasts, webinars, and so on. They've created spaces. Some of their theatres and institutions, the Market Theatre Laboratory, the Magna Theatre in Cape Town, they run parts of them. An arm of it is an educational institution that has got their people all at home, perhaps, and they're still running those. So they're still giving. So where their production may have been called to a halt, or their most of their actual operations in the building may have been called to a halt, they're still keeping it going in that way. A lot of people are So number one, they're also number two, they're also talking, and number three, they're also creating.
Right.
I've written two new things, and many people I know are still working on and creating new things that are waiting to go, that are ready to go.
Sure. What's happened to, I should really ask your parents about this, but I've got you on the line anyway. What's happened to the theater awards and theaters and all that kind of thing?
That's the Naledi Theatre Awards. They have announced their nominees for the productions that ran through the previous year. And they were looking at doing it online, are now hoping they can do it in a live space because of the new easing of those restrictions. That's under discussion. That is something that's always struggled for funding in itself.
Yeah.
And the most incredible thing, there's a line I mentioned in that letter, which is really important to me, that artists celebrate each other. We don't just go, oh, no, that person's in competition, or that theater, or that whatever your art may be is in competition to me. When someone does well in our industry, we want them to do well because it celebrates the arts and all of us.
Yeah.
And at that Naledi Theatre Awards, it's an incredible thing to see. I know you've been there. I think you can see when someone wins something, not just their production group in that audience celebrates, but everyone seems to, because it's good work. And it's an amazing thing to witness. So hopefully that does happen. They are on that mission to still try and find the means to make that happen.
Right.
My parents have fought that fight long and hard. It's a beautiful question to ask, that you ask, because I know you know them, and that was the privilege of my upbringing, in that I grew up in these spaces with artists. And I took my kids for a drive down Commissioner Street before lockdown sometime quite recently, and those old beautiful theatres are now broken down cliques buildings and shops and so on. So the too many of them are closing, and let's hope no more do.
I know, I drove past the Alhambra the other day, and it was horrified to find that it is now a funeral parlor, amongst other things.
Oh no, really?
Yeah.
Ugh. Let's not
beautiful
go that
beautiful building.
Yeah, but how's that for a metaphor, huh? No, yeah. let's you know, go there, because that's so galling,
dramatic.
Josh, you know, one of the things that when I was reading your letter that I thought was quite poignant, as it were, and I think a lot of people, even outside of the arts, feel it, is how
Sorry, Pumi, you broke up.
Oh, no, right as she was getting into her stride.
Hang on a second. Let's just see if we can get her back.
Okay.
Sometimes these things have a little bit of a lag on them. Oh, Josh, dude, what are actors and dancers expecting in terms of reopening? Are they going to see it happen in the next month, in the next 2 months, in the next 3 months, while we wait for Pumi? What does it look like? Is there any clarity from government on that stuff? Because even people who just love going to see live performances of some kind, for them it's been frustrating because they can't even go and see the shows that make them laugh, make them smile, make them cry.
I love the fact, I see Pumi's joined again, so I look forward to hearing what you were saying there, Pumi. Gareth, I love the fact that you said people are also, the audiences, people are also perhaps missing the theatre. That's really awesome.
Sorry, my app crashed.
Okay.
All right.
My app crashed. But the fact that, and we feel it, because we want to engage with each other.
Yeah.
It's more than just the words that you hear. It's the body language. It's how people respond. It's the light in their eyes. It's all of those things together. That's why even in Zoom meetings, a lot of us are kind of zoning out, because we miss the third dimension of conversation. It's not just in speaking and listening, but it's also in watching and kind of getting all of those other visual cues as well. That's what I miss the most when I watch the concerts online, you know. So who was Mark Lottering did a thing the other day, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's great, but it's not the same. You know, you want to feed off the energy of the people next to you. You want to feed off the energy coming off the stage. You miss that third dimension of it. And that's what I miss the most.
And Josh, I just think you're too right about the arts, because especially in the context of this country, so I don't want to speak about any other country, but South Africa is, if you look at people in suffering, and most of our country is, you go right back to slavery. Things like capoeira have become even in suffering, the arts are even more necessary, and we can see it throughout history. So we need the arts now more than ever. So I think it's poignant what you're saying. I really believe that we will pay for it.
I think people are far more willing to pay for entertainment than even education. But it's got to be entertaining. Gareth, you were saying make them smile, make them laugh, make them cry.
If you can do that stuff.
That's the one thing that I feel kind of, we will pay for it. We pay for entertainment when we are entertained, when we are engaged.
Right.
People will pay for it.
You know, I love what every one of you are saying, and thank you for your support on this. I think Gareth, you spoke earlier on about the quality of things.
Mm.
You just did now too. For me, it is very, very important to find even just a handful of moments that move an audience. And that is an amazing thing to challenge yourself to do, even in when we do corporate theater, even when we do maybe a film or listening to a voice or a piece of dance without words. If you can move an audience for a handful of moments, you've, number one, got them. They won't change the channel.
Yeah.
But also, you can communicate the story because you feel it.
Yeah,
and that's an incredibly powerful thing.
All right. So what are we hoping to get from the letter?
That the conversation continues. Cia and I were talking last night. I've written a follow-up letter to that. I'd love to share it with you. I'll publish it wherever I can. That you guys, that this platform perhaps is sparks off further conversation with government and corporate South Africa. The small industries, we are gig workers. We can't survive without it. That's not handouts. That's support to tell your stories, our shared Mzansi stories.
Well, Josh, keep fighting the good fight, man.
Thank you very much.
All right. Very, very good.
Thanks for your time. Thanks for the chat.
No problem at all. Josh Lindberg, everybody. That's amazing. Very good. Apparently, this is amazing. This is some interesting info. Robert says that Mark sold 15,000 tickets at 75 rand each. It's probably the most successful one-nighter ever. So it does miss the live element, but his innovation will keep him in business. That's Mark Lottering, obviously. Very, very clever. So that shows you, like, you know, you can also use an opportunity like this to do what Josh was saying and be more creative. So I like that. Okay, very good. Thanks, everybody. That's all we got time for because we've got to get to Blind History now. And this episode I was talking about now, we talk about the arts. The amazing thing about these three artists is none of them was really rich. They were rich at various times, but then they were very quickly poor again. So maybe it is the lot of the artist to always be financially insecure. Isn't that a sad reality for people to deal with if they're genius and they're creative? I mean, it could be, right? I mean, it could be, Pumi. It doesn't have to be, but it could be.
No, but the thing for me is what has distorted it is we live in this hyper-consumerized environment that makes us think that success can only be measured with the ice dripping from your neck, you know? No.
And we also romanticize the notion of the struggling artist. It doesn't have to be that way.
That is absolutely true. All right, cool. Well, we've got to wrap
point
this
taken.
Up. Yeah, we got to get to Blind History. That is next, cliffcentral.com, and we will see you tomorrow at 6 o'clock, bright and early.
Bye-bye.
Close your eyes and imagine a world of complete silence. No speech. No wind blowing. No birds chirping. No music. By the time Beethoven completed his Ninth Symphony, arguably the greatest symphony ever written, he couldn't hear a single note. There is a great irony in the triumph of a monumental piece of music and the genius who never experienced the glory of his own creation. But the stories of Mozart and Bach are as tragic and as incredible. These are the lives of the three great classical composers. I got into bed last night and I was up until 12:15 researching the three great composers of classical music, Johann Sebastian Bach, Wolfgang Mozart, and Ludwig von Beethoven. And I can't tell you, I didn't really know that much about their lives. I'd heard their music, all of us have. But I am such a fan now. Don't you agree, Ant?
100% agree. I wasn't sure if I'd enjoy the research on this, but I'm so relaxed after researching and listening to some of the music.
Well, I don't know how we should go about this, because we really could do an episode on each of these three guys. They were all phenomenal human beings. But let's start with Bach, because he was the oldest, the earliest. He was born in 1685. I just want to talk about what the three of them had in common. All three really had very unhappy lives. They had very difficult lives.
All of them had a very difficult childhood, and the fathers played a massive role, either dying early or being extremely domineering or being alcoholic.
Yeah. And it's just amazing when you think about the fact that these three men who had such incredible output, they composed reams and reams of sheet music. There are famous melodies and songs and orchestral arrangements that everyone in the world today knows. I mean, they're more popular in Japan than they are in the country of their birth. But amazingly, all three of them had pretty ordinary lives. The only one who was really celebrated during his lifetime in a massive way was Beethoven, when he died and had 20,000 people at his funeral. Mozart had a pauper's burial. It was actually quite sad.
But I also think it's a lot to do with the time. So if you weren't royalty, then they used to put you in multiple graves.
Yeah.
And it's actually quite sad that they don't exactly know where they're buried. I mean, if these guys lived today, 20,000 would be a poor attendance in their funeral.
Well, let's start with Bach. So he actually was orphaned, as you indicated earlier, difficulty with parents. He was orphaned. Both his mother and father died when he was about 9. He lived with his brother, who studied with the great composer Pachelbel. And there is a link between almost all of these guys: Haydn, Handel, Pachelbel, Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart. And it's a kind of tenuous link, but we'll explain that in a minute. He went off to music school, Bach, and he learned the organ and the harpsichord. But he wasn't, unlike Beethoven and Mozart, he wasn't seen as a prodigy early on. You know, he really put in the hard work, and he copied sheet music, and he worked for some very ornery noblemen through the course of his time. But the guy was absolutely amazing, and he had such discipline, and he loved music so much. He once walked 400 kilometers in Germany. He walked the entire distance to go and hear an organist play.
That's correct. And after he listened to it, he wanted to actually be taught by Dietrich Buxtehude, who was a very, very well-known organist at the time there. And he stuck around for 4 months, and he wanted to succeed Buxtehude. But the requirement was that he had to marry Buxtehude's daughter, and he didn't want to do that. So he promptly walked back. He walked home.
You imagine inserting those terms and conditions into a modern contract of employment.
Yeah, exactly.
So Bach had basically three periods in his life in terms of composition. The first one is in his early 20s, and he married his cousin, Maria. He had some children with her. In fact, altogether, he had 20 children.
Yeah, he was a significant procreator.
He wrote lots of the preludes and fugues and the well-tempered clavier during this time. But he did get bored with the religious music, and he actually got into arguments with his employer and got locked up in jail for a whole month.
Well, his whole ideal was he wanted to take over as the Meister, and he'd been there for 5 years, and he didn't get the job. So he was overlooked, and he was absolutely crazy. So he left that particular court and he joined a rival court. So the Duke got a bit upset and chucked him in jail.
His second period was with Prince Leopold of Curten. And he mostly wrote non-religious music and secular cantatas. And this guy really saw the genius of him, because it was at that point that he gave him money and said, you know what, just write music, just compose. And that's where he came up with the amazing Brandenburg concertos. And of course, I mentioned Handel earlier. Handel was the great composer who was actually born in the same year as Bach. And Handel was already quite famous, but they actually never met each other, despite being around at the same time and knowing about each other quite well.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interlinked, and it's amazing that three of the greatest classical composers all lived sort of very, very close to each other. But what was so important was the platform laid, or the fertilizer put down by the Enlightenment that gave the opportunity for them to express what they had. And the amount of music that these guys produced in the 100 years from the beginning of Bach to when Beethoven passed away, it's just incredible.
To just finish with Bach quickly, because there's quite a lot about his life that we're going to have to skip through, unfortunately. We have to cover the other two as well. But he wrote over 300 cantatas at a certain period in his third major composing period. And that was when he was in Leipzig. And he had the job as the cantor of St. Thomas's Church, where he's buried. And he wrote these 300 cantatas. And a cantata is a complicated movement. It's actually about 20 to 30 minutes long. And it's equivalent to composing, during the same time frame, 150 pop albums of today. That's how much music he managed to write during a space of probably about 1 or 2 years.
That's incredible. And he had a massive high work ethic. And also across a whole lot of different genres. If we look at that song, Everything's Gonna Be All Right, that was a direct sample from the Suite Number 3, the orchestral Suite Number 3. It's just so much of our music today is linked to these guys.
But this guy had a bit of a temper, didn't he? Bach was, he was very willful and quite bad-tempered. I mean, all three of them were, actually. But Bach apparently got into a knife fight with a guy.
Correct. I think he was a very, very serious individual. And often when he was told to come to the court, he believed it was for his talent. But it actually wasn't. He had to go and not only had to be part of the orchestra and lead that, he also had to teach some of the students. And he hated teaching. He absolutely hated teaching. And the one time, it's amazing, he actually said to one of his students, "You're a nanny goat bassoonist," which were in those days fighting words.
Yeah.
So the nanny goat bassoonist hit him with his walking stick. And which is interesting that I don't know why Bach had a dagger, but he did. So he had a dagger.
He pulled out a knife.
He pulled out a knife. But overall, he was a very serious character. His children talked a lot about it, and his second wife talks a lot about it.
Well, Germans are not known for their sense of humor, and he was absolutely one of those stereotypical Germans. But he did throw his wig at someone once and told them that they should have been a cobbler rather than a musician. And he did have all those children, and there are not many details about the kind of personality that he had in terms of what he infused into his music, because Baroque music, which was what he was still composing, is more or less formal. So it doesn't really let you express yourself the way that Beethoven and Mozart maybe expressed themselves in the more classical music they wrote. But he had a stroke in 1750 and died then. And there are copies of Bach's music that have been found in the papers of Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven. They all knew who he was, and they all took inspiration from him. So in some ways, he was a progenitor to the next two.
They mention the godfather of classical music, Johann Sebastian Bach. Just briefly mentioning at his time of his death, he had cataracts, and there was an intrepid doctor that believed he could solve these things. It basically was pushing the cataract deep into the eye. So he went blind, and then I think the shock and the devastation killed him. He basically died a year later, just after that. Yeah, it was a man who was, he was orphaned by, as we mentioned, the age of 9, and he lost 11 of his 20 children. So
tragic.
Yeah, and that was in infancy and childbirth. And he really loved, although it was his cousin, yes, he really, really loved his first wife, and she died, you know, at quite a young age. So it seemed like such a difficult, grief-stricken life. And they spoke about, you know, in the transition between when he lost his wife and to when he married Magdalena, he was grief-stricken and sleeping with groupies in the organ loft, dueling, fighting. So it was almost like our hard rock stars of today.
Sleeping with groupies in the organ loft. Wow.
Exactly, yeah. Okay.
All right, let's turn our attention to Mozart, whose name is well known to everyone on earth. Even if you're a complete ignoramus, you will have heard of Mozart. And Mozart, in some ways, is the most famous composer of all time. He was born in 1756 in Salzburg. And he was a child genius. I mean, he was composing at the age of 5 years old. He played the piano and the violin, and he toured all of Europe from the age of 7. In his life, he wrote 600 masterpieces, not just 600 songs or symphonies or cantatas or movements. He wrote 600 masterpieces. And the saddest thing of all is he died before he'd even turned 36.
Yeah, I think that the world lost so much what he could have produced going forward.
Now, obviously, when you have a child who is that much of a prodigy, they're also a little bit precocious. So a lot of people were put off by Mozart in his youth, and his father was like his manager. And his sister, whose name was Nanelle, she was like his co-star. And they would go around Europe like a touring band, really. And they'd perform for royalty, and they went to France, they went to England. He actually met Handel, which again connects us from Bach to Mozart to Handel. And he went to the Royal Society, and someone wrote a paper on him because he was such a curiosity. He was such an amazing genius. And then at 12 years old, he went back to Salzburg, and they wrote an opera. He wrote an opera, and it was rejected. And he was quite downcast by that. But he had no luck in terms of the relationships in his life, except towards the end where his wife, which we'll get to in a minute, gave him some comfort. But he had a friend who drowned. You know, he'd met the Pope by that stage and already received the Order of the Golden Spur. And really only after a lot of this hard work in his childhood, which reminds me a little bit of Michael Jackson almost, did he start settling into his life.
His father pushed him so hard. You talked about that 4 years. If you can just imagine, he was 7 years old and they went on a 4-year tour. And during that time, he got sick, but they were earning income, and the father realized it very much, that his two children were the source of his wealth. And even when they got sick, you know, he still kept them there. And I think that's a very, very tough childhood. But having said that, he was a massive genius, precocious genius, and people kept telling him that. At such a young age, he was set up for failure to integrate properly into society.
Yeah. And he fought with all of his employers. So there was, you know, famously the archbishop in Salzburg was the big boss. And his father worked for the archbishop. And because of that, it made it really difficult, because Mozart was, you know, trying to be creative and do his own thing. But the archbishop needed him to compose things every week for the church. And his father was a complication, because if Mozart behaved badly, the archbishop would take it out on the dad. So it was really messy. And Mozart always had trouble with money. He just never seemed to have enough money.
Yeah, and he went through a good stage, very, very famous, and he was performing all the time. And he was a brilliant performer. He used to do such incredible things on the keyboard, almost like a trickster, playing, you know, different tricks and that. And he earned a lot of money, but then he'd move into a big house, burn all the money there to move into a smaller house, then a smaller house, then an apartment. And Constance, his wife, she enjoyed it even more to spend all the money. So it wasn't a great partnership from that perspective.
Apparently they both liked fine clothes. But it's interesting, you mentioned Constance. Now, he actually fell in love with her older sister. And then the older sister went off and married someone else. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. But there's not a lot written about the intensity or how sad he was. I mean, he moved on very quickly to the sister. And all intents and purposes, that was ended up being the love of his life.
So just a few things about him. He was actually offered the job of being the organist at Versailles for the King of France, and he turned that down. He was supported, and one of his best friends in his life was Haydn, the composer we've already mentioned. He probably most famously wrote The Marriage of Figaro, which got him the greatest standing ovation in Viennese musical history. He was a Freemason. He composed Don Giovanni, which Beethoven came to visit Mozart at this time, and they met just once. Mozart said some very complimentary things about him, and they only met that one time. But Mozart was made the court composer by Emperor Joseph II of Austria, and he composed 3 great symphonies in 6 weeks, just in his head.
It's just incredible. I'm just trying to picture how he could do that. But they say he had these tunes in his head. And I suppose that's why he was quite peculiar. He was such a massive genius. But he still retained his childlike manner in the way he carried himself and sometimes crude sexuality. And he did have humor. I mean, compared to Bach, they were completely different.
It's lucky for him, though, that he did meet Constanze and that they did have a good marriage, because he didn't have a long life. So the happiness that she brought him, even though the two of them had constant money problems and he had to pawn the silver and all kinds of other things, she was there for him when he got sick. And he was weighed down by his finances, but they say he had a fever, rash, sweating, diarrhea, swelling, pain and vomiting for 15 days before he died.
They've mentioned that he was possibly poisoned by Salieri, which was another famous composer, fellow composer, that might have poisoned him. You know, there was a lot of competitiveness and jealousy amongst the composers at the time. But they really don't say that that's true.
No, in fact, in 2009, they went through the death records for Vienna, and they found that there was actually a small epidemic at the time. It was like a streptococcal infection, and it did make people swell. And it seems to fit the bill, according to forensic scientists, for what actually ended up killing him.
Yeah, and I think Gareth, in the end, he had a modest burial. And as you mentioned in the beginning, although not quite a pauper's, what they say is the neglected genius.
Yeah, I mean, it was a mass grave, and you'd pour lime on, and then they just cover you up with a whole bunch of other bodies. And there is a memorial to him in the cemetery in Vienna, but we don't know if he's actually buried under there. And here was this guy who various musical geniuses since have called the most extreme unequaled talent of all humankind in music. I mean, that's a hell of a thing to say about someone.
I've listened to the music. It's just incredible. You know, even Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, that we might sing lullabies and those type of things. I mean, it's also come direct reference from his music. There's just so much in our life that we hear. Adverts are played by all three of these composers. Yeah. Adverts we hear, they're in the background, it's their music.
Even as a kid growing up in cartoons, you would hear some refrain from one of these great composers and you'd think, oh, okay, you know, that comes from this guy. You'd find out much later. So let's move on to Beethoven. Ludwig von Beethoven was born in Bonn in 1770. I actually visited the house he was born in 2 years ago. And at age 7, he had started publicly playing the piano. 1783, he began writing his first works and earned a living as a composer. He supported his whole family. So tell me about Beethoven's dad, Johann.
He saw what Leopold Mozart did with Mozart, and he wanted to do the same thing with Beethoven. But Beethoven wasn't a child prodigy like Mozart. It took him a while to get into it, you know, to warm into the music.
But, I mean, let's also admit that his father was a raging alcoholic long before.
Yeah, but it was scary, the very difficult, abusive relationship that took place with his dad. And, I mean, that had a massive impact, a profound impact in his life.
So he actually became the head of his own household at age 18 and took over his father's job as the boss of the house and therefore had the burden of looking after everyone in the family. But before that, he'd been introduced to Neefe and the other classical masters, noblemen, various noblemen in his part of the world in Germany had paid for him to go to Vienna, which was the capital of classical music. And he went off to Vienna and he met Mozart, who we've just spoken about. And Mozart stood and watched him play and was so impressed that he went next door to find his wife in the room next door and to tell her to come and look, because this kid was someone who would give the world something to talk about.
Yeah.
What an amazing meeting for these two great people to have been in the room. Only once did they meet.
Yeah, I just can imagine. Just incredible. Just between them, what they've written.
Apparently, some of Beethoven's music is so difficult to play that musicians still refuse to play it to this day. And he said to one of them during his own lifetime when they looked at what he'd composed and they said, this is impossible. He said, do you think I give a damn about your miserable violin when the muse visits me?
But he was a notorious daydreamer.
Oh, yeah?
Often he used to just sit and he would be so preoccupied or he would be engaging with somebody and he would just get up and walk outside or get up and write on a board. So he was very deep in his own head.
But he had a problem that I think a lot of nerds have, and he was definitely a music nerd because he was a loner. I mean, he'd been beaten when he was a child. He was quite a scruffy kid. He had pockmarked skin and he was quite dark. They called him Sicilian. And he was short as well, so not a great combo. And he had what many nerds have, an infatuation with girls who are just out of his league. And he kept falling in love with these noble women who obviously rejected him because he was just a common man and they were going to go and get married to people of their own stature.
And also he never dressed properly. He was always disheveled. And apparently he used to go through stages where he didn't bath.
Yeah, apparently 3 weeks at a time, he wouldn't change his clothes. They'd always be covered in like food scraps. He would leave food lying around in his apartment. There was just sheet music and like food scraps lying around. And It's amazing that he managed to even survive what most people in his position wouldn't have survived. I mean, he found that he had a ringing in his ears somewhere around his late 20s, and he knew that this meant that he was going to lose his hearing, but he was so proud that he wouldn't admit that he was going deaf, and he became violent and abusive, and he'd get quite physical with people, and there was a lot of rage, justifiably. And of course, he'd been turned down by these women, including a Countess Jakarti, who he'd written the famous Moonlight Sonata to in order to woo her.
Yeah, that's one of the more ironically tragic parts of his life. You know, he just breathed beauty in music that he created, and you need your hearing. And that was very, very sad that the one sense that you really, really need, he lost. And that's what makes him, for me, the most remarkable of the three.
Yeah. Well, he wrote the Third Symphony, and this is another link to one of our previous Blind History episodes, for Napoleon, whom he idolized. And when Napoleon had himself declared emperor, Beethoven fell out of love with him completely because he felt he'd been betrayed like he had by his own father. And he was staunchly a man of the Enlightenment. And so he actually tore Napoleon's name out of the manuscript for the Third Symphony. And you can see it today. His name has been torn out, and he dedicated it to the hero instead.
Yeah, that's a very famous part of Beethoven's life. He so admired Napoleon, you know, during the early years.
Well, another interesting thing, I mean, there were 9 symphonies written. He was hoping to write a 10th before he died. But famously, by the time the 7th symphony was written, he had to press his ear against the wood of the piano just to hear the faintest sound of what he'd actually composed. And it was around this time that he famously had the immortal beloved in his life. We don't know who it might have been. There are possibly 2 candidates who may have been the immortal beloved. But this was obviously a woman he was desperately in love with, who either did or didn't love him back. And there are rumors that he might have had a child with the Countess von Braunschweig. But we don't know for sure. And most of his life was miserable and lonely.
Especially with the hearing problem. I mean, that just, he went into his shell because he couldn't engage with people. First of all, he tried to hide it because money was also important to him. Mm. So he had to earn a living, and he had to hide it for a long period of time. But they did find letters. That's what you're alluding to, Gareth. Yeah. Nobody knew who it was, but they were definitely romantic letters.
And he never sent them. They were found in his papers, you know. And he just never had the courage to send them to whoever this woman might have been. But he did have a very ugly custody battle over his nephew later in his life. And it really dampened the enthusiasm for him in the public realm. First of all, because it was humiliating to him that he'd always cultivated this idea that he might have been of noble birth. And the trial evidenced the fact that he was not. He was just an ordinary man. And that boy that he ended up getting custody of, his own nephew, hated him and tried to commit suicide.
Sure, that was a big, big thing in his life. It really, really hurt him. I think it was quite close to when he passed away. And I think that was one of the reasons, definitely, that affected him.
Well, those last few years of his life in the 1820s were really his most prolific. He wrote the most amazing music that he'd ever written. And he kind of rebounded, even though he'd had this very difficult and complex existence up to then. But he was absolutely enthralled by and in love with music. And he wrote the famous 9th Symphony, you know, the Ode to Joy, which is just the most passionate and optimistic piece of music. And it's the first symphony ever to use a chorus. He never, at the performance of the 9th Symphony, which was absolutely spectacular, people stood up and they were enthralled. And he didn't even know, because he was so deaf, that the musicians had to turn him around to look at the crowd to see the applause that he was getting.
And then he started crying. I think there was one term that just said there was tears coming out of his eyes.
But it's so funny, because when he died, apparently there was also a big clap of thunder, and he was lying in his deathbed and he raised his fist to the heavens, almost like defiant, you know.
Just to look at a little bit of a summary with Beethoven, you mentioned before about different periods in the lives of all of them in terms of what they're producing. And when he was young, he used his predecessor's music in many of his early works. And I think in the time they used to call it like Mozartian type of music. Mm-hmm. And his music became deeper and stronger and richer. And in his last years, when the deafness had sort of blotted out his world, I mean, some of the music that he produced during that time is phenomenal. And I think from that perspective, it's just such a triumph over adversity. And this is probably why, for me, Beethoven is just the most remarkable of the three.
I love him too. It's very hard to choose your favorite, but I've probably heard more Beethoven music than any of the others. And I just love everything I hear. He was also the guy whose music is on the Voyager spacecraft, which is still traveling through space. So if any aliens ever find it, they'll find Beethoven on there. He's the EU anthem. The Ninth Symphony is the EU anthem. And when they brought down the Berlin Wall, they were playing Beethoven's music as it came down.
If only these guys knew.
Yeah. Well, they, in their own lifetimes, they just never had this kind of success. Although he was a pretty much a big celebrity by the time he died.
He wasn't like Mozart, where he just spent all his money. He looked after it, looked after his family.
Well, he left everything to that nephew who tried to kill himself. So at least there was an upside to him in the long run. But it's interesting, someone much more worldly than I once said that talent is something a man possesses, but genius possesses the man. And that's true for all three of these guys.
Agreed.
Well, we hope that you've enjoyed this season 3 of Blind History. It's been an unbelievable roller coaster ride for both Ant and I. I mean, I've enjoyed it so much, and I've discovered so much about people that I thought I knew.
Yeah, for me, it was incredible. Some of the characters that we talked about, when you looked at them in the beginning, I thought, but these people blew me away. I mean, in completely different ways.
I am so pleased that we went into the characters of people like Eva Peron and some of the bad guys, you know, Genghis Khan and Ivan the Terrible. And after 3 seasons, I feel like I could just keep going forever.
Yeah, me too.
Well, maybe we will. Keep an eye on this spot. This is cliffcentral.com. Blind History Season 3, Gareth Cliff and my co-host, Anthony Medera. That's a wrap.
What really interested me in this part of his life was that he was so shit at maths. And, you know, we get our teachers whipping us and say, hey, you need maths in your life. And you have to do this. Oh, maths. Maths is everything. Beethoven was so bad at maths, and look what he created.
Yeah, and then there are those people who'll tell you that music is just like mathematics.
Yeah. So he proved that wrong.
Cliffcentral.com.